Yes. Our next speaker is Dr. Hassan Uldadag, and he'll be speaking to us on scaffolds, growth factors, and tissue constructs. Please welcome.
You can have this here.
Okay. Oh, should I?
No, I'm just saying for her, she heard her. Let's get used to that.
Okay.
Microphone.
Okay.
And your mouse to point.
Sounds good. Good morning, everyone. I actually want to thank you guys for coming to Edmonton. I realize that Edmonton is not the most convenient travel destination, so it's really great to see you all here. It's really making a good impact to our university. I was originally scheduled to talk about scaffolds, growth factors, and tissue constructs. And Dr. Tariq Albiali has briefly mentioned about tissue constructs, actually. So I'm not going to talk about tissue construct. Instead, focus on delivery systems, just not to spread myself too thin over a number of areas. I want to talk about scaffolds and the delivery of growth factors in the context of bone regeneration. And bone is one of those tissues that we have that exhibits quite a bit of regenerative capacity. I think most of us had a bone fracture sometime in our lifetime. And actually, bone heals quite nicely. Within 6 weeks, 2 months kind of a time frame, there is quite a nice healing in the bone. Except for certain individuals, for older individuals, for individuals on certain type of medication, bone really has a hard time regenerating. I'm going to talk about some of the concepts of stimulating bone regeneration using growth factors, and you can actually take these concepts and apply it to other tissues as well. I just want to start by saying that bone exhibits a very orchestrated process at the molecular and cellular level. There's a very predictable sequence of events that happens during the healing process. Typically what you have when the bone integrity is compromised, so when you have a bone fracture, typically one of the first things that happens is a hematoma formation. You have a blood clot, it stabilizes the wound site so that angiogenesis can start. Bringing new blood vessels into the site is probably one of the most critical events. This angiogenesis actually brings an influx of stem cells that comes from the blood vessels as well as from the surrounding tissues. There is an osteogenic differentiation over time, so bone-forming cells start to appear at the site, and these cells essentially start to lay new bone tissue at the wound bed. This bone deposition actually continues for a while, and it is ultimately remodeled. Typically, you get an excess bone formation at the site, and over time, somehow the body knows what is the right amount of bone, and this bone is resorbed over time in order to establish the original contours of the bone. You can actually look at this process at the cellular level, and this process actually is very well orchestrated at the cellular level as well. So the cells undergo chemotaxis, proliferation, differentiation, osteogenesis, and apoptosis at one point, which is very tightly regulated by the growth factors as well as the extracellular matrices. So if you want to develop a rational approach to bone regeneration, you actually have a number of tools at your disposal. And this slide actually reproduces one of the slides that Dr. Albiali has shown before. If you want to stimulate bone regeneration, one of your first tools is extracellular matrices. We all know that an extracellular matrix, the stuff around the cell in our bodies, is quite a dynamic scaffold. It's capable of modulating cellular activities. And you can use things like natural materials such as collagen or synthetic materials like hydroxyapatites in order to provide an extracellular matrix to the cells at the bone site. Your second tool to stimulate bone regeneration is growth factors. These are proteins that can regulate the cellular activities. So the activities that I talked about, those chemotaxis, proliferation, differentiation, these are regulated by these growth factors, proteins, which is typically soluble in physiological medium. And one of these prototypical growth factors is BMPs, bone morphogenetic proteins, which I will focus for the purposes of this talk. There are osteogenic cells, obviously, at the site, which are ultimately responsible for bone formation, and you can actually introduce cells to the wound site in order to stimulate bone regeneration. The state of the art right now is really focused on number one and number two, extracellular matrices and growth factors. Cells have been quite promising, but they have been slow to develop, and it is going to take some time, I think, for these products to come to the market. I want to give you a very brief history of BMPs just to give you a sense of the timeline that you have with these materials. BMPs has been around for a long time. In 1965, the activity of the BMPs have been described in a science paper by Marshall Urist. Essentially, he was able to describe a protein-like activity which is extracted from the bone, and when implanted at a subcutaneous site, so underneath the skin, you actually end up getting bone from this extract. It was an amazing discovery in the sense there was some soluble species there, protein, whatever, that actually ended up giving you a tissue. It's a unique discovery in the sense we don't have any other morphogenetic proteins for other tissues. We don't have a liver morphogenetic protein, for example. We don't have a protein that induces liver out of nothing. This BMP seemed to be able to do this. In 1988, actually, the cloning of these proteins has been described by John Wozni at Genetics Institute. This is a company in Boston area where I spent a few years at. He has described these proteins, and this was an important observation in the sense he was able to clone and isolate a single protein that reproduced the bone morphogenetic activity. So a single protein that ended up giving a bone tissue. After this report, actually an intensive activity has been focused on developing the delivery system for these proteins, because one of the earliest observations with these proteins was that the proteins were effective, but in order to get effectiveness out of these proteins, you had to use very high doses, 100 microgram plus kind of doses, in order to get some kind of bone formation, and that it was very unreproducible. If you were able to use a delivery system, a scaffold essentially, you were able to reduce this dose very significantly and also make the process very reproducible. So for any clinical development, the need for a scaffold was obvious right from the start of the discovery of these proteins. And after year 2000, there has been a number of approvals, a number of countries, a number of clinical indications, a number of publications are out there, and I encourage you to read for the clinical performance of these for these proteins. But I just wanted to give you this slide to give you a sense of the timeline from 1965 to 2000 in order to develop a protein as a clinical therapy. So right now there are actually two of these devices on the market. One of them is BMP2 device, so this is a BMP2 protein which is soaked with a collagen sponge implanted at the bone site in order to stimulate bone regeneration. There's an equivalent device called OP1. This is BMP7, actually, which is delivered with a different material. And actually, Dr. Platika yesterday has referred to this particular device, OP1 device, in his talk when he was talking about bone regeneration. So I don't want to talk about the clinical performance of these devices, but what I want to do is actually give you the science and the technology behind these devices. So let me just start by giving you a representation of one of these devices. This is a representation of an osteoinductive device. And essentially what this device is a biomaterial scaffold. I've shown that as this white holy material here. A scaffold, a biomaterial extracellular matrix in a way, which contains the BMPs. BMPs, when implanted, are released into the physiological environment. So there is a BMP release to the environment, and at the same time, cells come into these scaffolds and start to get differentiated and form new bone. So we wanted to develop a good understanding of these devices, and one of the first questions that we asked was, what was the effect of the biomaterial scaffold on BMP release kinetics from these implants? we actually realized very quickly that measuring release kinetics was very difficult in vivo. Once the protein is released, it goes all over the place, it gets metabolized, and it just becomes impossible to track that down. So rather than measuring the release, what we started to do was actually to measure retention. So how much of the protein is actually retained in these scaffolds? And one of the first studies that we have done was to compare some of the clinically used scaffolds and look at their BMP retention profile. And this is the summary of this data. What you are looking at is how much of the BMP is in this scaffold after 3 hours of implantation in an animal model. 3 hours. You will see a large variation in these materials. Some materials that are retaining BMP up to 70-75%, some that is retaining BMP as little as 10%. So 10 to 75% is quite a range. You can imagine that you are implanting a BMP, 90% of this protein is being lost right within the first few hours of implantation. I mean, that tells you that there is a loss there. You're almost sure that you are wasting your protein. We looked at the subsequent pharmacokinetics as well, so how much of the protein is retained in these scaffolds after a certain period of time. This is a two-week study with different biomaterials, and the nature of the biomaterial is not important for the purposes of this talk, so don't focus on that. But you will see that there are some biomaterials, like the blue one here, which doesn't release BMP at all, so it sticks to the BMP like a glue. But there are other materials which actually releases the BMP very quickly. So within 2 weeks, you actually have less than 1% of the initial dose. And to be able to compare these materials, I actually normalize the first time point here. So this is a normalized volume. In fact, when you think about the initial difference, subsequent pharmacokinetics, you end up getting 3 orders of magnitude difference in the local protein concentration among these materials. Quite a significant variation. As you have seen, I have talked about BMP2 and BMP7, actually, and there are a number of BMPs out there that actually has this bone-inducing activity. And so the next question for us was, how does the retention of different BMPs are affected in these implants? And this is an experiment, this is a study that we conducted using two types of carriers, two types of scaffolds, a collagen on one side and polyglycolic acid, a synthetic scaffold on the other side, using 6 different proteins. Again, the nature of the proteins is not important. But you can see that there are significant variation in retention of these proteins as well in both of these scaffolds. The scale is log here, so when you look at the differences, there are 2 orders of magnitude difference, actually, between these materials. So 0.1% versus 10%, for example, after 2 weeks. And the difference is actually revealed right from the first time point. Within 3 hours, you have this major difference between these proteins. So the type of the BMP that you are implanting with these scaffolds is quite significant when it comes to retention. The obvious question is really, what does this retention profile have to do with the osteoinductive activity you are getting? And we were surprised that this simple point was not explored for a long time, even though the BMPs has been around for quite a while. So we did a study for this, and it sounds like a simple question, but it's a very difficult thing to address. You basically have to somehow come up with different delivery profiles, different delivery or retention profiles, and correlate the different delivery profiles to the osteoinductive activity you are getting. To be able to do that, to get different retention profiles or delivery profiles, you have two options that I just showed you. One, you can actually change the biomaterial. You can use a different biomaterial so that your delivery profile is different, and then you can use the same BMP, BMP2, let's say, and look at the osteoinductive activity of different materials, assuming that the induction of bone is due to difference in retention or delivery. The second strategy is actually to keep the biomaterial same, but change the BMP. BMP, the type of the BMP changes the delivery, so we can change the BMP in order to get different delivery formulations, And actually, we found out that the second strategy is a better way to pursue, because as soon as we change the biomaterial in strategy one, we actually have changed a number of other physiological processes which complicated our analysis. So we have pursued the second strategy, and for these purposes, we have chosen BMP2 and BMP4 and looked at the retention and also inductive activity of these two proteins. We chose these two proteins because these two proteins are as close as it gets when it comes to protein composition. Their amino acid sequence is 92% similar, so that they have similar activities under in vitro condition. And when we did this study, we actually saw quite a significant difference between the BMP2 and BMP4 when it came to retention. So you can see that BMP2, which is the yellow line here, is retained to a higher extent than BMP4. The difference is 3 to 5 times different at all time points here. This is a 2-week study. And when you look at the osteoinductive activity, what you are looking at is the implanted dose versus the amount of bone formation. So this is 2 micrograms of BMP implanted. You actually start to get a small amount of bone formation with BMP2, whereas with BMP4, we don't see any bone formation at the 2-microgram dose. At 5-microgram, we have a robust bone formation, BMP2, little bone formation with BMP4, and the higher doses actually give you strong bone formation with BMP4. Just looking at these, I think it should be clear to you that the BMP, which is retained higher, actually is giving you a more robust bone induction activity. So we have, for the first time, correlated the retention with the osteoinductive activity. And the implication of that is that if you can come up with a delivery system that actually keeps the BMP at the implantation site in the scaffold, you actually have a better chance of getting a robust bone formation. So we can start to design engineered scaffold in order to achieve this retention. And we have recently tried to attempt this issue using a different type of scaffold, actually, an injectable scaffold. All the experience that I just talked to you about was with implantable materials. So you had to have a surgery in order to introduce your scaffold into the body, implantable system. We wanted to translate these results into an injectable system where you didn't have to open up the body in order to introduce these devices in. So you could just simply inject it into the body. And we have attempted to do this using something called temperature-sensitive polymers, and what we essentially wanted to do is to mix these polymers with BMP in solution. So you have the polymer and the BMP in solution, and simply inject them with a syringe into the body. This is a temperature-sensitive biomaterial. What that means is that it is soluble, it is injectable at 4 degrees at a low temperature. You can put it into the fridge, and it's going to be soluble. But it will be insoluble at body temperature at 37 degrees. So as soon as you inject it into the body, it actually solidifies, gels, and creates a scaffold at the site of injection, and hopefully entrapping the BMP at that site as well. I don't want to bore you with chemical formulas as to what these polymers are made up of, but I just want to show you some pictures about these polymers to give you a sense of the type of gels that we get these polymers. And here are 4 different polymers, actually, 4 different structures that we got from 4 different polymers that we synthesized. You can see that some of these structures are quite open. They have quite open pores. These are pores in 10, 20 micron size, so the cells can actually get in very, very nicely, very quickly. But some of these scaffolds are quite dense. These are, for example, small, less than 1 micron pores, so cells have a hard time getting into these scaffolds. But these scaffolds have a high mechanical strength, which might be useful for bone application. So we can easily tailor these scaffolds, make them injectable, and tailor their properties. And here's the bottom line with these scaffolds, with these injectable scaffolds. What you are looking at is the BMP retention profile for BMP2 over a 2-week time study in an animal model. And so this is similar retention profiles that we looked at, that at one point, this is day one, we have 30% or so retention at the site of injection. This is an intramuscular site of injection. And that if you have BNP alone, so the red line here, if you have BNP alone, you actually have a very rapid loss of the BNP, so to an insignificant level after day 7 stays the same. This is essentially a background. If you have the wrong biomaterial, BMA, for example, again, the details are not important. If you have the wrong biomaterial, you actually don't influence the pharmacokinetics, the retention profile. So this injection with this biomaterial essentially gives you the same retention profile over 2 week time. But if you choose your biomaterial right, these three biomaterials, you can see that you can significantly enhance the BMP retention at the site. And at the end of the day, you can enhance it as much as twofold. So 100 times better retention at the injection site because of the presence of these biomaterials. This profile that you are looking at here is actually very similar to the profile you obtain with implantable devices. So they have an injectable system that you are able to administer, simply inject, and actually keep BMP at the site as good as an implantable system where you have to open up a surgeon, where you have to open up a patient. And I will not show you the activity with these devices, but we published this data some time ago, and I'll be happy to talk to you after the talk. Certainly, you can deliver BMPs with injectable systems. You can use the scaffolds to deliver genes. You don't have to stop at the protein stage. You can actually utilize these scaffolds to deliver genes. So instead of delivering the BMP protein itself, you can actually deliver the BMP gene. And this work actually independently was pursued, was reported approximately 10 years ago, almost late 90s, by three different groups who has provided proof of principle for this approach. I just want to show you one study actually from this approach where people have delivered a large number of BMPs using adenoviruses. The advantage of the gene delivery, you can imagine that delivering the genes is more complicated. You don't have just the protein, you have to give the gene, somehow the cell has to take that gene, express it for a given period of time. So there's a number of more technological barriers in order to achieve that. But there's one big advantage to delivering genes, and that is you don't have to produce the proteins. You can skip the protein production. Protein production is a pain, actually, for those of you who knows how to produce proteins. You don't have to produce the protein. As soon as you have the sequence, for example, 1988 paper that was published on BMP2, as soon as you have the sequence, you can actually take that sequence and go to the gene and deliver the gene. Much rapid way of assessing a biological activity. So this approach actually was used to screen a large number of proteins for a number of BMPs. This is BMP2 to BMP15. And look at the osteogenic activity. You can see that the ones that have the bars high, BMP2, 7, 6, and 9, show some osteogenic activity in culture. The same approach has been used for ectopic bone formation in a mouse model, and you can actually, it's a little bit difficult probably to see, but the same proteins, 2, 6, 7, and 9, actually gives a very robust bone formation. So here is a possibility of delivering the gene and inducing bone formation. But the reason I wanted to share this with you was because it was an interesting result in the sense some of these proteins, BMP6 and BMP9, these two, are actually not as active as the other proteins when they are delivered in protein form. The clinical devices right now is based on BMP2 and BMP7. This is BMP2 and BMP7. And the reason it's based on BMP2 and 7 is because they are very robust proteins. But when you do a gene delivery, you actually see 6 and 9 being as robust as these two proteins. So that gene delivery actually might give you stronger activities, unique activities, where you wouldn't get it with the protein delivery. And that's an important thing when you are trying to find out a biological function or an efficacy of an unknown gene, for example. I want to switch gears a little bit and talk to you about one last application of these proteins, and that is the use of the growth factors for systemic bone therapy. Everything I talked to you about so far and all the clinical devices we have are for local bone regeneration. A fracture site, bone is fractured, that's a local bone regeneration. You don't really care what happens to bone at a different site. Wouldn't it be nice if actually we could utilize these growth factors for systemic bone regeneration, take the protein, put it in a vial, inject it so that it distributes all over the body, and it ends up at the bone and stimulates bone formation everywhere in the body, for osteoporosis, obviously. The problem with that is that these proteins don't go to bone when you inject them. They go all over the body. So the protein ends up in kidney. If you have a bone-inducing protein in kidney, you can imagine that's not the most desirable situation you want to find yourself in. So we started a research program some time ago to actually take these proteins, modify them so that they are bone-seeking, so that they end up going to bone rather than going to somewhere else. And we have done this based on chemical modification of these proteins with bisphosphonates. And I'm sorry, BP means bisphosphonate here. Essentially, what we wanted to do was to take the protein, attach a bisphosphonate to it. Bisphosphonate has a high affinity to bone. If you inject bisphosphonates, 50% of the bisphosphonate go to bone, so that when you inject this construct, you have a better chance of taking the construct to the bone. And I gave you the structure of some of these bisphosphonates. The last one here is alendronate, is a drug called Fosamax. And some of you might be familiar with this drug. It's an osteoporosis drug. It's developed by Merck, an osteoporosis drug. And it's an osteoporosis drug because it goes to bone, it absorbs the bone, and actually slows down the process that causes bone loss. It inhibits osteoclasts. We wanted to use these chemical entities for bone targeting. Forget about the chemistry. We actually realized that we actually had to come up with new types of bisphosphonates in order to do this work effectively. These are bisphosphonates that actually has four copies of phosphonates. So it's a dibisphosphonate or tetrabisphosphonates. So two copies on one side, four copies of the bisphosphonate on the same compound, so that we can actually modify the proteins easier. Again, these are unique compounds that we had to come up with. And I just want to show you one last slide I just have, is how effective is this approach. And to measure the effectiveness of this approach, we use something called targeting efficiency. So that is defined as bone delivery of bisphosphonate conjugate divided by the bone delivery of the native protein. So when we have a targeting efficiency of targeting efficiency of 1, that means the conjugate and the native protein is delivered to the bone to the same extent, so there's no advantage to the bone, the conjugation efficiency. So anything above 1, anything where we get bone delivery more than the native protein is good. And here is the summary of a large number of studies that we have done. These are animal studies using different proteins, actually. This is albumin. The yellow ones are albumin. Green is lysozyme. This is a protein called fetuin. Again, albumin with these unique bisphosphonates we have, and BMP2 at the bottom. Using different chemistries, different substitution ratios, different administration routes, we want to try these different things to get a sense of how effective this approach is. But if you look at these numbers, you will see that most of them are larger than 1. So by using this approach, we can actually target proteins to bone most of the times. There are some exceptions. One of the proteins that is giving us a hard time is this fetuin, so not all proteins go to bone. And the best scenario that we have achieved is 7.5. So we are able to deliver to tibia albumin after 2 to 4 days, 7.5 times better protein targeting than the native protein, unmodified protein itself. This has been successful with BMP2 as well, with a targeting efficiency of 3 or 4. So right now we are focused on the biological evaluation of these proteins, and we are actively pursuing to find out whether increased bone targeting actually results in increased bone tissue induction. So exciting things we can do with these proteins. that's where I would like to stop for today. And I just want to leave you with this slide to give you a sense of the people behind this work, some of our collaborators, and the foundations that are paying the bills. Thank you very much.
Now we have time for some questions.
Check. I'm just wondering, for the injectable scaffolds, is there any, do they degrade over time, or is there any potential downside to them, you know, remaining?
Yeah, I mean, that's an obvious question. For this particular scaffold that we designed in the rat model, which is a highly metabolizing model, within 2 weeks, these scaffolds disappear. We cannot trace them down. When we recover the implant site, the injection site, we can trace the bone, but we cannot trace any of the scaffolds there. So they are easily degrading type of materials.
So you showed us some nice targeting efficiency to bone. I guess the other side of that equation is that you would want the targeting efficiency to other organs to be near zero. And are there problems with any of the ones that you've shown us in terms of also targeting things like kidney for clearance or liver stuff?
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, when you target things to bone, in theory, you should reduce the targeting to other sites. Most of our studies, we have found evidence that targeting efficiency to other tissues goes down. There are a few exceptions, especially with fetuin, there are a few exceptions where we see that targeting efficiency to some other tissues also increases for some reason. We don't understand that exactly. So most of the time, we see a reduction. And one of the things that I've been disappointed is actually the extent of reduction is not very much. I was expecting reduction efficiency 50%, 100% kind of at other sites, and we don't see that. We see maybe a 20% reduction to other sites, which is still okay, but not as much as what I anticipated. And that's a very good issue. It's something that we have to optimize before we pursue any further, actually.
Did I hear correctly that you said that the biphosphonates inhibit osteoclasts?
Yes.
So what do these polyphosphonates do? Do they have similar pharmacological spectrum?
Pharmacological activity, yes. That's a very good question as well. So we are interested in using the bone targeting ability of these bisphosphonates. So in addition to bone targeting, if we are able to get bone osteoclastic inhibition, that will actually work in our favor. So there might be a double stimulatory activity. You are increasing bone formation with the growth factor, reducing bone loss by the osteoclasts. But I don't think that will happen because the pharmacological activities of these bisphosphonates are exhibited at a very high dose, and the doses we are using for protein targeting is probably 10 times less than the clinical doses that are used. So we are not reaching to that dose level where the pharmacological activity of the bisphosphonates are exhibited.
The reason I'm asking is that what you would expect if you block osteoclast activity completely is that you get a totally different quality of bone laid down.
Yes, yes. And I think that information is just coming out with more and more clinical studies that osteoclast is good to increase the bone mass, but the quality is becoming an issue. And that's something that we have to address as we go into more and more studies. Thank you.
We have time for one more.
If you use the gene, and it's an adenovirus gene, you are actually producing it so it goes into bone cells. I mean, it's got to go into the bone cells to be expressed. You could actually put a regulatory sequence in the gene so it's only expressed in bone cells,
yes.
And that would give you maybe an even better way of delivering it to the tissue where it's required.
Mm-hmm. That's a good point. If you're able to use a promoter which is specific for a cell type, mm-hmm. you can make the bone cell express, for example. In the case of BMPs, It is acting actually on the stem cells. It is acting on the stem cells and transforming them into bone type of cells. So sometimes it acts on the muscle cells and makes the muscle cells into bone type of cells. So not necessarily a bone-specific promoter, but a promoter that's appropriate for the target.
Yes, thank you.